Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century.
Join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together. If you're loving this podcast, we invite you to go deeper and partner with us in our work by joining the Gravity Commons, our online community of practice for connecting and learning together.
As a member of the Gravity Commons, you get access to live podcast recordings with upcoming guests, as well as other opportunities to connect and learn together with us in real time.
Including learning labs, member meetups, discussion boards, online courses, and our practitioner podcast. Go to gravityleadership.com/commons to find out more. See you in the commons.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, everybody. Mm-hmm. Hey. Christy, welcome to this podcast. Matt, welcome to this podcast.
Thanks. First time,
see you guys.
First time listener. First time listener.
Wait. First time listener. First time. And caller. And host. No. Y'all, you know, the news. You guys catch the news sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard of the news? It's blowing up right now.
It's blowing up. The news is blowing up.
Flint, Michigan still does not have drinking water. Is that what you're saying? That news?
That might be true.
Isn't that crazy?
Is that true?
Yes, it's true.
Is that part of the news? Goodness sakes.
That's not the big news.
That's not the big news, but it is. If you live in Flint, it probably is. It probably feels like big news. We're recording this on Friday, September 9th, and that is the day after the Queen died. The Queen of England died, y'all. Mm.
Yeah.
And that has been occupying a lot of the news' attention. And I put this in the Friday links. If you guys aren't signed up for the Friday links, gravityleadership.com/join. We send you an email every Friday with some cool stuff in it. So we join us. That'd be fun. But I put this in the links because there's just tons of stuff on the internet about the Queen's death from all kinds of different angles, and I found it fascinating. One of the things that I found fascinating, I don't have a link to this tweet, so I can't link it and I can't read it verbatim. But one of the things I resonated with it because what this guy said was for a lot of certain kind of like. Person in the United States, a white person in the United States, white people in England, they think of the monarchy and they think of the queen in sort of fantastical or mythical terms, right? We almost like conjure up Lord of the Rings kind of images, right? That's our vision of monarchy and the pageantry and how lovely and, you know, the BBC is putting out these, you know, tributes and that kind of a thing. And I realize that is my sort of automatic, like, I don't know much about the queen, but that's sort of my automatic sort of sentiment about the queen is like, oh yes, what a quaint, interesting institution they have over there. But then I saw all these other kinds of links to, for example, like Irish, like the Irish people are celebrating. Right? Which feels to us like a little bit of like, oh gosh, should you be doing that? But there are Scottish people. And just realizing that like when you come from the underside of colonial power, you have a very different picture of what it means to be a monarch and a very different picture of what the royal family means. So I was just interested in that contrast, I guess, because this queen has been around for a long time.
Yeah, 70 years. I didn't realize there was that much animosity between the Irish and... British.
Right.
Like,
we don't.
I mean, I knew there was some, but I didn't realize like dancing and celebrating. Like, that seems so disrespectful.
For example, it does seem disrespectful, but when you think about the history, so this is something I just learned. The potato famine in Ireland.
Oh, yeah.
You ever heard about that?
Yep.
You know why there was a potato famine?
Heard of it?
Because the English shipped the potatoes out of Ireland to feed English people. Mm-hmm. There was plenty of food to feed all of the Irish. But the English took it. Mm. And so they have this long history of oppression, colonialism. And of course, you know, our nation is part of that. So I remember reading this. One of the tweets was from Marlena Graves, who has been on our podcast. Mm-hmm. Do you guys remember her?
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was kind of a funny tweet because she said, here's a quick explainer on why African Americans, Native Americans, the Irish, the Scottish, people from the Caribbean, people in India and Africa and other parts of Asia may not hold the same view some white folk do in the US or she said the UK, she said, I should have said England, about the Queen. Here's the explainer. It's one word. Colonialism. So anyway, I thought that was kind of a funny tweet.
But, yes.
I don't know. I guess I realized, like, unless I was reading those voices and seeing some of these things that initially sort of felt, like you said, Christy, disrespectful to me, it's invisible to me.
Yeah.
The experience of the colonized peoples and this long history of oppression, it's pretty much invisible behind the pageantry, you know, like it just looks nice to me. Mm-hmm. Looks nice.
Do you know what I noticed and when I heard the news was this odd, like I'm not from England, mm-hmm. But this odd sense of grief, mm-hmm. not because like I'm like a huge fan of Great Britain and like, or not because I know a lot or studied a lot about the Queen, but because she represents a woman in power, mm-hmm. and a woman leading, and she's been consistent for 70 years. Yeah. And in the midst of all these other leaders failing and falling and like doing really dumb things, it appears as though she has been faithful, mm-hmm. and consistent. And anyway, it's just, as a woman, it's interesting to me that was my response. It was really unexpected.
Sure.
So I don't know. I'm still chewing on that. I don't know.
It's complex, in other words, right? This is super complex, and there's, I don't know if that's the definition of intersectionality, but, there's something of that, right? Yeah. Where she represents this colonial power, but she's also a woman. Yeah. It's super interesting. And she has been around for a long time, like you said, 70 years. But to put that in context, I read this thread of facts about what that means. Christy, how do you mind sharing your age? How old are you? Are you 42?
I'm going to be 45 in like 2 weeks. Okay.
So if any of our listeners are 42, just think about what it feels like to be 42. The Queen was 42 when the Beatles released the White Album. Can you believe that? I just was like, wait, what?
Wow.
Like, it's crazy. She had... like 30% of U.S. history, the Queen was the Queen.
That's wild.
For 13 U.S. presidents, she's been the Queen.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway, so she's been around for a long time. And I think one of the other things that's interesting to me about this, we got to get into Drew Jackson here. And this is connected to Drew's book in a way for me. But I think one of the interesting things is that we think of colonialism as ancient history. But it's not. It was just a couple years ago, really.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like a lot of this stuff has happened very recently. And so, no wonder people are still mad.
Right.
What I mean? Like it's just, anyway, I've been thinking about a lot of this stuff. So.
Yeah.
Can we, I don't know. Any other thoughts on that before we transition to Drew Jackson here?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of takes on the Queen's death, but. The one I found most profound was the one that talked about how her obituary is not going to mention that she dressed exactly the same as Cam Newton. It has a picture of her.
Speaking of hiding facts.
It has a picture of her in a blue suit with like a blue hat. And I just, it's so funny because Cam Newton is an NFL quarterback who's, I don't think on the team right now, but he would wear the most... ostentatious outfits.
Yeah.
And I think that's just such a funny thing to think about.
There are a lot of, yes.
That Cam Newton and the Queen of England had the same, had the same wardrobe.
Yeah, the same fashion sensibilities. That is another aspect of this. I mean, this is a complex, there's some grief, there's some anger, and then there's just a lot of funny stuff out there as well. People are making really funny jokes right now. So anyway, I don't know.
Tell us how this fits with Drew Jackson, though.
So speaking of Cam Newton and, I don't
oh
know.
Oh, my goodness.
I think the way that I think about this in connection with Drew's book and Drew's work is that, you know, Drew's book is called, the one we're talking about is called God Speaks Through Wombs. And it's this it's a work of poetry. Drew's a poet. And it's this poetic retelling of the first 8 chapters of the Gospel of Luke from the perspective of liberation of marginalized and oppressed peoples. And so they talk about how the history of the story of the Gospels has been co-opted. The story of kind of what Luke is doing has been co-opted by the powerful. And I think that Drew, for me, represents a voice that helps us understand the perspective of marginalized peoples in a really helpful way, much like, you know, the Irish responses and the, you know, African-American responses to the Queen's death are helpful to, you know, to me, even if they sort of offend my sensibilities a little bit initially. They're helpful to me to say, oh, okay, there's a different experience here of, you know, being on the underside of oppressive power. And I think Drew's work is really helpful in that way.
His book is really great. I actually own it. And and I'm preaching on Luke 7. And I actually read like the poem that he wrote that was connected to it. It was just refreshing. It's just refreshing.
Yeah.
So it gives a different perspective and I appreciate it.
Yeah. And he connects those marginalized voices to his own experience as a black man in America. And, you know, it's super helpful. I also love too that he does this through the medium of poetry rather than, I mean, prose is fine, you know, direct, you know, kind of speech is fine. But I think there's something really remarkably powerful that happens when these kinds of things are spoken in an artistic way. There's a chance I think it has to sort of get underneath, I don't know, like it's almost like a parable, right? Where it has a chance to sort of sneak past your initial defense mechanisms and, you know, set off a grenade behind enemy lines.
Yes.
If you want to think about your own mind in that
interesting,
way.
Interesting. Yeah.
He paints a picture with his poetry that is powerful and it sticks in your memory. Yeah. And so, actually we read one. I think we read two
podcast poems,
and it's good.
It is good. All right. Well, hey, that's probably good enough. Oh, I'll mention this too. Just in case y'all are not on our email list, we are starting a learning community on our book, Having the Mind of Christ. We just finished up that series, but it's going to be a 10-week learning community Thursday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to walk through the book together in community, kind of using some questions to discern kind of how to get these axioms from our heads into our lives, into our bones, into our bodies. So anyway, that starts in a couple days, September 15th. We're going to run 10 weeks all the way through November 17th. We'll put a link to the show notes in the show notes about it. But if you go to gravityleadership.com/LC, you can join us. There's still time. We'd love to have you in our learning community.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be fun.
All right.
All right. I think that's it, everybody. Are we good to go?
Yeah.
Let's hear from Drew.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Today we have Drew Jackson, who is the founding pastor of Hope East Village in New York City. He and his wife have twin daughters and live in Lower Manhattan. And we're talking about his book, God Speaks Through Wombs, Poems on God's Unexpected Coming. Drew, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Tell us, fill us in. What else do we need to know about you?
Well, you know, we've been here in New York for about 5 years at this point. We planted a church in the East Village. I've kind of been all over. Grew up in South Jersey, just across the bridge from Philly, so I have deep Philly loyalties. finished high school in Atlanta, and then was up in Chicago for undergrad. Out to LA for seminary, back to Pennsylvania, lived in the Lehigh Valley in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania for a little bit before coming to New York. So it's been a little bit of a journey, but here we are. and I write poems.
I love it. I love it. Did you come from like a literary background? How did you get into writing poetry and prose?
So my mom was she wrote. That wasn't her main thing that she did, but she was an artist. So she was an interior designer. And so she was always creating, but she also was a writer, and she, you know, like for our church, right? She would write all of the church plays and things like that. She wrote poems, and that was just kind of who she was. And so I definitely developed my love of words from her. I would say in addition to that, I grew up loving hip hop. And so I'm the youngest of four boys. And so my older brother schooled me in hip hop. I just growing, you know, just riding in the back seats of their cars when I was a kid and listening to all the lyricists, the Nas's and like Rakim's and people like that. And I just fell in love with wordplay and word choice and how they work together. And so that kind of developed over time. I, in college, was writing my own lyrics, but then it's funny, like I got married and jumped into full-time pastoral ministry and I stopped writing, or all of my writing became sermon writing, until a couple years ago when poetry found me again and started really writing in the form that I am now.
What does that look like for you? Like with a practice, like, Matt and I just finished, writing a book, a nonfiction book, but I, you know, that was like, we put the proposal out and then it's just like, okay, we got all these deadlines and we got to make sure that, you know what I mean? All this kind of stuff. But it strikes me that poetry, like a book of poetry, like you've got to be at this for a longer time. It seems to me, than just like, okay, I made a proposal for a book of poems and, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud about the writing process. And I'm wondering if you can fill us in on that. Like, what does this look like for you? Is there a practice that you have of like, I'm going to write a poem every day, or and then what's the selection like? What's the process like of selecting poems for a book like this?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you're right in that there is a sense in which, like, I'm at this for a while, although this particular collection didn't take me long to write, but it was by the time I submitted, like I came to the publisher, my manuscript was done. So it wasn't like I came with this idea. I had the poems already. And because so much of it, you're right, it's a practice of, for me, poetry is first and foremost a spiritual practice. And it is, you know, coming to it in a, it found me, the poetry that I'm writing now really found me at the beginning of the pandemic. And I needed something, being here in Manhattan on lockdown, nowhere to go, you know, small apartment with, at the time, five-year-olds, two five-year-olds. poetry was a lifeline for me. And it wasn't just that, but it was also, and I'll talk a little bit about this more later when we talk about the specifics of the book, but just with everything going on with, you know, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, all that stuff sort of swirling at once. I felt like in that moment, I needed some conversation partners who weren't going to tell me that I was making stuff up about race in America or gaslighting me into saying that it was worse than it, you know, it's not as bad as it is. And so I found those companions in the Gospel of Luke. And so they became conversation partners for me in the poems. And so, yeah, it was this practice of just sitting with those, letting the questions that I was holding in my heart come out on the page without the need to resolve them. And so just kind of sitting in that over time.
Well, your book really goes through the first eight chapters, right, of Luke. And is there one that stands out to you as like, this one This one had my heart for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a poem. There's a poem called "The Waters of My Weeping," and it's in chapter three, and I wrote it in reflection on this a small verse, Luke 3:20, where Jesus receives the news that his cousin John has been arrested. And yeah, this poem really, really did something to me. It was when I talk about finding a conversation partner and a companion in this journey, this was one of those that I feel like really kind of exemplifies that. Jesus happened to be that conversation partner. Should I read it? Or?
I would like you to read it, because awesome. Here I want our listeners to know, like, you're an amazing author, but the way that you give the prose, there's probably a word for that, mm-hmm. but
the poem
my heart.
Yeah, the poem, I think, because Christy and I heard you read some of your poetry at a live event we were mm-hmm. at together, Drew, mm-hmm. and I think that it, you wrote it, I can't imagine someone else reading this aloud.
Yeah,
I think right. that's, Christy, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like, and actually when I ordered your book, like the night I heard you first give your first prose and you like gave your poem up there, I like sat in my chair and got on Amazon, ordered your book. And then when I started reading it, I was like, I don't even know you very well, but I was imagining your voice because my voice didn't seem to cut it. So I'm glad that you're on the podcast. And yes, I want you to do it because I don't want to do it. So if you would be willing to share The Waters of My Weeping, we would love it.
Yeah. The waters of my weeping. One of my brothers, my cousins, added to the number of your incarcerated masses, one in three of us. Unarmed? Yes. A threat? Yes. To your abuse of power and the way you sit so comfortably in your palace while we struggle to eat out in these streets. But in this hour, I weep again. For this innocent man baptized into your carceral system, immersed into this jail with no bail, I am forced to witness this unholy sacrament, this state-sponsored religious act. And for what? Something about his person disturbed you. Maybe by passing him through these waters, you will convert him to the faith of unsacred silence, one way or another. I'm sorry that it frightens you when we fight for our humanity. But tonight, I cry. These tears have become my food. I dip myself in the pool of the waters of my weeping. For my brother. For my cousin, for all of us, until they stop locking us up.
I'm snapping. I'm snapping into the microphone here. Drew.
Thanks.
This is something that I think I'd love to hear you talk about more. Mm-hmm. You name like the catalyst for this book, the muse perhaps, was the fear, anger, despair, rage that you were trying to process and make sense of as you mentioned George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all these things are happening. And then you go to scripture, mm-hmm. Which, you know, seems like a long way away. Mm-hmm. What did you find? And I think it's there in your poem. What did you find in scripture that helped you metabolize, process, order, and make sense of some of what you were feeling?
Well, there really, we talk about the muse, right? There were two things that came together. So it was one, I sort of named it. The other thing was that I was really interested in the, at church at the time, we have a practice of returning to the Psalms to just sit in, as a practice, right? And so started to preach through book 2 of the Psalms. So, you know, the Psalter is 150 chapters, five books of Psalms. And there's the rabbis used to talk about how the five books of the Psalms are, they are sort of in conversation with the five books of Torah, and they're not meant to be commentaries on them, but they're in conversation with the themes of those books. And so as we were sitting in book two, I started to say, what would these Psalms sound like, these poems? What would they sound like if I reread them with the backdrop of the book of Exodus? How would they sound different? How would they land differently? And I started to do that, and you immediately start to see that, you know, there's a whole different understanding of things that starts to come through when you're wrestling with and sitting with the themes of liberation, right? God's liberative work in the world on behalf of the poor and oppressed. And so when you get to the first poem of book two of the Psalms, and you hear, "As a deer pants for flowing streams, so my soul thirsts for you, O God," it's more than just an individualistic cry of a pietistic person, right? This is a communal cry for God's rescue, right, in the midst of a dry and weary land, right? Like, you start to hear those things. And so I got curious this is just something that, I don't know, happens in my mind. I'm like, what would poetry sound like if the Gospels were to give rise to them today? And so the Gospel of Luke, I was just drawn to it because of the themes that Luke is already trying to pay attention to, where he's trying to, in his telling of this narrative, center the voices of those who are on the margins, to say we need to hear these voices telling this story. So whether that's the voices of the poor, whether that's the voices of women, right? Like, the Luke is very intentional about how he's telling his story. And so I think that's one of the reasons, because I knew that Luke was already doing that, it just made sense in the time we're living in right now, that we've been living in for a long time, but to come to this gospel and to say, how can I talk to some folks who know what it feels like to live on the underside of empire, who know what it's like to have a history of a people who have always been struggling underneath the foot of oppressive regimes, who are trying to make sense of God in the midst of that, who are trying to hold on to hope in the midst of that, who have learned the language of lament in the midst of that, and who I don't have to explain myself to, right? And so that, I think it was that I was, that just sort of was all swirling around me I was writing this.
Hi, I'm Mac from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and I've been through a Gravity Leadership Academy cohort. Here's the bottom line. If you want to be discipled and learn how to make disciples, then this is for you. I serve as a pastor, and GLA has had a huge impact on me and my leadership. Not only will you find tools and resources that are highly reproducible, but you'll be connected to a group of people seeking to center their lives in the love of Jesus. If you like the Gravity Leadership podcast and the conversations taking place here, I think you'll love going deeper in a Gravity Leadership cohort.
To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
I want to reflect back two things, Drew, that were significant for me in what you said. The first is, the scripture was written, most of scripture was written by people who were captive, conquered, or colonized. Mm-hmm. And so these people understand what it's like to write from below, or from the outside, or from underneath. And then the second is, I think I was trained formally and informally to approach the scriptures to get a better picture of God. Mm-hmm. But what you're naming is the other aspect of this, is that the scriptures also want to give us, the scriptures also see us. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we know who we are better because they tell us.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you found people who got you because they understood what it was like to be you. Mm-hmm. And that helped you connect with God better.
Absolutely.
Am I hearing that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think even when we understand Jesus as not just someone who shows us what God is like, but who shows us what it means to be human, right? Mm-hmm. We find that. And I mean, the scriptures say of Jesus that, you know, because he knows everything that we've been through, right? That's right. Hebrews talks about him serving as our great high priest because of what he's been through, because he's been through the same things that we have. And so if I take that seriously, then I can come to the scriptures, to the gospels in particular, as I'm reading about Jesus and this story. And I can not only see something of the divine, of God, but I find myself in that company somewhere. And both to better understand who I am as a human being, but in particular, like, as you were, you know, as the scriptures were written from a place of being on the, to use the language of the underside of history, like, it, I always, whenever I'm teaching, right, I always say that it's always important to remember that Rome did not write this text. This text was not, this text was written by those who were under Rome's foot and under Babylon's foot. And so that should change how we read the text. It should also cause us to ask ourselves within the larger narrative of things, where, what social location do we occupy? Who are we as we come to the text? Right. And I think that a lot of times, one of the failures of the church in America at large, and I use that, you know, it's a broad brush to paint, but is that there's been this impulse to identify ourselves with the below rather than saying, hey, are we Rome in this? You know, how would the text change? How would our understanding and reading of it change if we saw ourselves as Rome? Yeah. And the gospel, the good news of the kingdom was coming to us.
Yes.
You know, but I say in my intro that I'm speaking and I'm writing unashamedly as a black man navigating this context and bringing the stories in that lineage with me. And so I have always, whether in direct ways and in indirect ways, been told that I have to sort of check that at the door when I come to reading and interpreting scripture. And, right. You know, I think the truth of it is that every single one of us has a lens through which we read and interpret scripture. We all do.
Yep.
That's not a bad thing. It's just a thing that we can't help. And so, It becomes harmful when it's unacknowledged, when we don't recognize and we just say our interpretation is the interpretation instead of a interpretation. Yeah. And so that's what it was. It was just, all right, I'm going to bring my full self to this, which includes my blackness. It also includes my imagination. Right.
Yeah.
So that's, I just sort of was like, if I just let my imagination go, because I also believe that that is part of what God has given us as an imagination.
Yeah.
You know, where would that take me as I'm reading and writing these poems? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how will I meet God in the space of the imagination?
Yeah. Yeah. Drew, your poems, are fairly, they're related to the gospel, right? Because you're reflecting on the gospel of Luke, and they do sort of proclaim, they help us hear the gospel, which is very similar to, you know, the work of preaching. Mm-hmm. You're a pastor. I wonder if you could just reflect a little bit. I'm curious about the craft sort of aspect of this, of what do you see as the difference between, those things are maybe similarities between your poetry and your preaching, but what's the difference? What are the differences between writing poetry that maybe helps us see something of the gospel, but then also like preaching the gospel, you know, to your church Sunday after Sunday. What's the overlap there? What are the distinctions in your mind between those things?
Yeah, I think one of the key differences is that when you're preaching, you're always trying to make the text plain for people, right? You want to make it plain. I think with poetry, it's not always the case. There's a sense in which in a poem, it's like I'm not trying to obscure things, but I'm also not trying to, I don't always feel the need for explanation. I think that's the best way to put it.
There's not as much of a teaching kind of element to poetry.
Yeah.
Not that poems can't teach, but there's not this burden or goal to make it teaching.
I think poems, at least, and this is something that I've actually grown in my writing of poetry over time, but that poetry, I think, is always inviting us more deeply into a question rather than providing an answer, rather than seeking to provide an answer. And which is also one of the reasons I think that there's large chunks of the Bible that are poetry that are less concerned about here, this is the answer you need, but is an invitation to stay with the question or to stay with the mystery long enough for it to transform us. And that's what I think poetry is meant to do. It's always inviting us to just stay with the questions that are emerging in us, or helping us to discover what are the questions that our soul's already asking. And to just stay there, to linger there, to not rush on. It's like, you know, we don't often think about Jesus as a poet, but Jesus used poetic devices, especially in his parables, all the time. Whether that's the use of simile or metaphor, or, you know, at the end of his poem or his parables, Jesus will say things like, "Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear." It's his way of saying, "I'm offering this thing to you that seems cryptic, and I'm not going to give you an explanation." You know, unless you stay with it. And in particular, his parable of the four soils, the parable of the sower, when he tells that parable and he says, "Whoever has ears to hear, let him hear," you see two things happen, right? You see the crowd who hear this leave perplexed at what he said. And his disciples, his students, they come to him and they ask him the question, "Can you help us understand some more?" Yeah. And that's when Jesus says to them, "To you has been given the secret of the kingdom. And to everyone else outside, it remains in parables," right? That there's something about the invitation to stay longer with the question rather than just to walk away frustrated with the riddle, that I think poetry is always beckoning us to come and do that. I think good preaching should do that. I think it far more reverts to, "Here's the answer you need. Here's your three steps for a better life," or whatever it is. So I think I actually found some freedom in being able to write something and not explain it all out. That was like that for me after having been writing sermons for so long.
Yeah, that's really well said.
Drew, your work is really good. And I'm not just saying that because you're on the podcast. Like I wish I was a poet. Like, I have this dream, but I'm like the roses are red, violets are blue type person. Uh-huh. And when somebody is gifted at that, it grips our hearts in ways that I don't have language for. And so it helps me be able to process things and learn things and sit in things like what you're talking about. And I follow you on social media, and I was surprised at my reaction. You wrote a poem after the shooting in Buffalo that I read and cried and then came back to it days later and read it again because I think my heart needed to sit in that and hear how other people were processing it. And I'm curious, we didn't ask you before, but I'm curious if you have that accessible and if you would even be willing to read that poem and kind of maybe double click on it a little bit and talk about kind of what was going on in your heart and how you penned those words.
Yeah. So the poem from the shooting in Buffalo, it's like there have been so many shootings and I've written several poems. So the Buffalo. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Tops Friendly Market, Buffalo. Six letters etched on the end of a gun. Running, running. Shelves tumbling over. Spilled milk mingling with the red river flowing on the floor. Blackberries scattered all around black bodies.
I think the pause is appropriate. The image and the words that you use in that I am sad. And I didn't have words. And you helped my heart have some words. And I just want to say thank you. I'm glad that your gift is being used in this way.
Mm. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. At the risk of wording something that is maybe unwordable, Drew, I think this is one of the differences. This is how poems speak truth that didactics speech cannot. Because you capture... The poem captures for me a photograph. I mean, I'm seeing everything you're naming. Mm-hmm. And it's a moment in time, but then there's movement within the moment of time. And so it's this dynamic snapshot of a moment that is devastating and tragic and demonic and that you can't possibly explain or resolve with a sentence. And so poetry, that poem, and other poems in this book, God Speaks Through Wombs, they open us up to truth we can't colonize. Mm. We can't fully grab it. We can't fully contain it. We can't fully, like, stuff it in a pocket, use it. You know, you can't use a poem like you could use a sermon to get people really going. Mm-hmm. It just is something that opens up space in you. And then if you read it publicly in others, and then it's a reverent space. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of truth things like Buffalo and, you know, you had to ask which mass shooting are you talking about? Yeah. That's just the world we live in right now. Yeah. That I don't know if we have any other speech act that can get even close to the truth that needs to be told about these things.
Mm. Well, I think when you said, it was like a photograph. That, I mean, that's essentially what I was trying to do, is to just take a snapshot. I wasn't there. But I was there, you know, and so, people sometimes ask the question, is poetry fiction or nonfiction? Like, how do you categorize it? And it's like, all right, I think what I really was trying to capture, I don't even know. Like, I come back to it and I'm like, what was I trying to capture? One of the things that I was trying to capture was just the images of something like a grocery store where you hear things that are common and familiar. The shelves, the milk, the berries, the right, like all of these, like there's just a store. And I think that's part of the point. It's just this everyday place that becomes a place of terror. In particular, terror for and against black bodies, black people, mm-hmm. who are going about everyday life at the ironically named Tops Friendly Market, right? And I don't know that there's more that we can do with that than just to come into the photograph of it and sit with it, right? I think that was all that was happening for me. It was just, how do I, and I think like personally, it was a practice of how do I not become numb to this? Because it is unfortunately so common. How do I not become numb? And it was like, sit with the picture of it.
Yeah, and the poem's brevity, I think, lends itself to that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just a resistance to make anything make sense, mm-hmm. to fully explain it, mm-hmm. to exhaust all the... It's just like this brief snapshot that we have to sit with. And I think numbness is one thing that I'm noticing. I'm on this mini sabbatical, and I've stopped getting my news from Twitter and Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I actually had the thought earlier today, I wonder how many mass shootings I don't know about that have happened in the last 4 days.
Mm.
Which is just a tragic thought to have. I mean, it's a tragic reality to live in. The other thing I was thinking about, Drew, is just, I have a friend of mine who put a post out about, you know, the day after the Buffalo shooting happened. And just how supermarkets have become something that's now a trigger.
Mm-hmm.
So the numbness, if it doesn't numb you, then there's just increasing reactivity.
Yeah.
Right? So now it's police lights and flagpoles and supermarkets, you know, and elementary schools, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have all these
churches, emblems, mosques,
synagogues, all these emblems of violence.
Yeah.
There's no question here other than maybe just gratitude, mm-hmm. because I think your poetry, especially as it connects our story today in the 21st century to the story of Luke, which mm-hmm. is very much concerned with the poor and mm-hmm. women and Gentiles,
mm-hmm.
that the scripture knows what's up.
Yeah.
It knows, like the people we meet there, they have a modicum of empathy for what we're dealing with.
Mm.
And we have mothers and fathers there. And I think your poetry connects, it opens us up to that healing and that parenting.
Mm.
So thank you.
Mm. I wanted to share this other one that I felt like sort of is doing something similar. It's different, but also brief. It's in the book. And this is, it's a poem called Who Can Forgive? And it's from that passage where Jesus and the religious leaders are having an interaction. Jesus forgives the man's sin, the man who's been paralyzed. And the religious leaders are saying amongst themselves, who can forgive sins except God alone, right? And I just, for some reason, that question caught me and took me to this place. And I was just going to, I'll read the poem to you and we can touch on it briefly. But the poem has, it's called Who Can Forgive? And it has an epigraph before the poem begins. This is a poem for the Charleston Nine in Botham Jean. Who can forgive a white man walking into our mother to shoot the roofs off black bodies? Who can forgive a white woman. Amber, light hair, plain clothes, wrong home, sending bullets through a brother. Who can forgive sins except God alone?
I feel like there needs to be some sort of, you know, when you eat sushi, you have ginger that cleanses your palate. You need like a ginger. Oh man, Drew.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess just thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have another book of poetry coming out.
I do.
In a few months, right? Will you tell us a bit about that?
January 10th. so the next book. Next collection is called Touch the Earth, Poems on the Way. And this is finishing out the Gospel of Luke. So, it's really a continuation of this project. It's different in that because there's a natural turn in Luke's gospel at this point, there's a turn in the poetry. It becomes much more about the discipleship aspect of things, right? Where Jesus changes course and is headed toward Jerusalem, right? And what does it mean to be on the way with him in that direction? There's a lot more, I would say there's a lot more of me that shows up in these poems, because a lot of it is me wrestling with what does it mean for me to be on the way. The book is called Touch the Earth because it's just this whole idea of how does what does it look like when faith touches the earth of things, when it gets into the dirt, when it puts on flesh, when it's not just concept but is lived, and is a part of the real rawness of being human. And so the poetry is just sort of exploring that, and in conversation with all of those things. So, that's January, coming January 10th.
Yeah. Nice.
Okay, I'm going to pre-order. Pre-ordering it, friends.
Yeah. It's one book of scripture down and one book of scripture down, 65 books to go, man, if you're going to do
there you go.
Hey, Drew, can I ask you a quick question before we go? I noticed, I was looking up that link there to your forthcoming book of poetry. And I noticed that Padre Otuma wrote the foreword.
He did.
Dude, I was going to ask you.
Do you know
about
Padre?
I do know Padre
Otuma. Okay.
Padre's a friend of mine, yeah.
Oh, that's so great. I was going to ask you poetry stuff for a long time.
I was going to ask you what poets you liked, and I was hoping you'd say Padre because he's got a way of turning common things inside out. With his words.
Yep.
And Drew, your poetry reminds me of that.
Mm. Yes, it does.
That's a compliment.
Your poetry reminds me of that. Mm. Anyway, I don't know how you feel about this, but sometimes when I introduce friends to authors or poets, even musicians whose lyrics are just really profound, I get so giddy. It's like I'm setting somebody up on a date.
Yeah.
You know, like making a matchmaker, you know, and Patrick is one of those. And you are too, man. I really appreciate you being with us today.
Yeah.
Taking some time. And if people, Christy mentioned your socials, how can people find you out there?
Yeah. Social media, Instagram. So D Jackson Poetics. You can find me Twitter, D Jackson Poetics. Spend most of my time in those two places. More so Instagram. Slowly, finding myself in the Twitter world a little bit more, but I don't know if I want to go there.
Nah,
Yeah, think long and hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Pray about that one.
Yeah.
My 10-year-old would tell you TikTok is where to be. So
I know.
That's one that pray about that
one. Well, Drew, it has been a gift. So thank you so much for being with us, for sharing your poetry and your life. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. I loved this conversation.
I could listen to him for a long time. I kind of wish it was just recorded. I could get it on Audible instead of the real printed book, because I think I would enjoy it more.
I think it is.
Oh, man, I guess I didn't even look at that. I should look.
Well, I was just, when I was looking up the book, I have Audible credits, and it was like, I wonder if he reads the book as well on the audio recording.
Oh, man. Maybe that's how I'll get the Touch the Earth one on Audible.
Mm-hmm. So. You get this one. Right. This one on Audible too. Audiobook. Yeah, let me check it out here, guys. Audiobook.
Put it in the show notes.
Well, the link to the book is already there, and so if you just go to Amazon, I think it's in there. Okay. The author, the narrator, is Drew Jackson. So
come on.
He reads his own
good
poems.
I like it.
So that would be a cool way to listen through this. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask him. Wasn't really on topic for our meeting, but I do have this hunch that a lot of pastors and preachers would be helped by regularly reading and writing poetry, including myself.
Gosh.
And I wondered like what his advice would have been to like people who want to get started, because I feel like I have several books of poetry that I have read through and come back to every once in a while. But I've never really tried writing poetry, and I wonder if that would be helpful for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, I don't really know how to start besides like, what do I do? Write down some words? I guess that's how you start.
He should do a workshop and teach pastors.
Yeah.
Here's some tips.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think sitting in it, like he talked about sitting in it.
Mm-hmm.
That in and of itself of like writing a piece of poetry on something that you're preaching would help our hearts and our heads to sit in it longer.
Yeah.
So it seems like a good practice.
Most def. Ben, I send you poetry memes sometime.
It's not, I mean, that's not really what I'm thinking about. That's not really what I'm talking about.
That poem from Mornings I sent you. Don't you remember that one?
Poem from Mornings.
What are you talking about?
Would you like me to read it to you right now?
Sure, if you've got it accessible.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's, PG-13, this podcast is not...
It is.
It's not rated R.
Ben.
Okay, all right.
Ben, I don't even use Christian swears.
Okay, yeah, it's true.
They suck. I don't have time for that crap. Here is the poem for Mornings. Mm-hmm. Coffee. Mm. Coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone shut up. Coffee.
That's beautiful.
Did you see how that does? It's very, it's very short, like Drew's poems
were. Short, yeah. There's some repetition involved.
You see, like there's a picture, you see a photograph in your mind of like somebody in a bathrobe about ready to lose it on their children.
Right. Hair all messy.
Mine would have needed like, and cream.
Cream. And cream. A little bit of cream too. Asterisk behind this
coffee. And cream.
Yeah.
Coffee and cream. Mm-hmm.
Coffee and cream. It doesn't quite have the same ring. So.
No.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I appreciate having that conversation with Drew. It was really nice.
Yeah. Well.
All right, friends.
This was good.
Mm-hmm.
This was real good. Real, real good.
Peyton,
hey, dog. Did I tell you guys what I did on my vacation?
Came to Colorado.
We did.
Some poetry.
We came to Colorado. And then before that, we were in Vegas and went to a karaoke bar. And I sang Danger Zone 5 times and got kicked out.
No, you did not.
Yeah. 5 times, Danger Zone got kicked out. Apparently, I exceeded the maximum number of logins attempts.
I was waiting for you on that one, Christy.
I'm telling you what, every single time we record these, I'm so gullible that I'm like, I know you didn't do that. You were at my house for a week. You never told me that story.
Now I'm going to have Highway to the Danger Zone in my mind the rest of the day.
Yes, you are.
That's my penance for doing that joke.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Hey, I recently saw, speaking of the Danger Zone, real quick, I recently saw online that the lyric is Highway to the Danger Zone, not I went to the Danger Zone. Did you guys realize that?
I did realize that. I've only thought Highway to the Danger Zone.
You've only ever thought Highway, Christy? Yeah. Did you think it was I went to the Danger Zone?
I always thought it was I went.
I went to the Danger Zone. I went there. I mean, Highway is more poetic.
But then he never says what he did there.
No, he just says he went there, and then I guess that's about it.
I know you got to run, Ben, but can I tell you a funny story that's similar to this that my 8-year-old once said? So you and my 8-year-old have similar thoughts is what I'm trying to get at. So we were listening to Daft Punk's song Lucky. Yeah. I don't know if you guys remember that song, but it was a big hit several years ago. And the chorus goes, we're up all night to have fun. She's all up all night to get some. We're up all night for good fun. We're up all night to get lucky, right? And then they sing that we're up all night to get lucky like, I don't know, 65 times. And my son turns to me in the middle of the song and he goes, Dad, they never say how they're going to get lucky.
Oh, sweet boy.
And I was like, that's probably why you're able to listen to it.
Yeah. It's implied. There's an implication here.
But, you know, you're like, he went to the Danger Zone, but he never said what happened there.
Yeah. He obviously came back. You know, it wasn't
that dangerous. Would you bring a report?
It wasn't that dangerous.
Anyway. All right, everybody.
All right.
Oh, you guys.
Love you. Well, hey, I love you guys.
See you next time. Oh, hey.
I love you, Ben.
I love you too, Matt. I love you, Christy.
I love you guys.
Yeah.
Listeners, we love you too.
We love you.
We love you, listeners.
Yeah. All six of you.
Yeah. It's more than that. Come on.
Well, is it?
It is.
At this point, it's down to five.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Who knows? After the dad joke, maybe people are like, okay, that's done. So.
And the morning poetry.
Yeah. And now we are done.
Good, all right, good, Pete's
good
friends.
Night, everybody. Peace.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, we'd love it if you'd tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
Joining our Gravity community is free. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our show is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast, and you can check out his work at aaronsternke.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Record button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.